You're listening to the Eurofolk Radio Network, and this is the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show with your host, Andrew Carrington Hitchcock.
Hello, everybody, and joining me today, one of my regular guests, good friend of mine, is Dr. Eric Karlstrom, and the subject of today's show is going to be Agenda 21 and the Man-Caused Global Warming Fraud. So I'll bring him up right now. Eric, are you with me?
I'm with you, Andy.
Excellent. Hello. Excellent. Well, great to have you on board, as always. I enjoy doing these regular shows with you every couple of weeks, and you've always got interesting information. Before we get into the topic of today's show, you've got four websites, I believe. Can you run through what each of these are for the listeners? Just give a brief rundown of the topics you cover on each one. And also, folks, the links to these websites are in the post for this show. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, well, actually, it's five. I taught for 30 years as a geography professor at three different universities. And along the way, I kind of developed some of these websites. And then since I've retired in 2011, I've put quite a bit more effort into these websites. You know, they say knowledge is power. And so these websites and the information on them, they're really digital libraries. And so, you know, if people are, you know, stuck at home for whatever reason and they can't afford to go to university, you know, they can check these things out and browse through them and learn what they can to empower themselves on some of these subjects. So my websites are, the one we'll be discussing most today is naturalclimatechange.org, also naturalclimatechange.us, and same thing. And then 911nwo.com, also San Luis Valley waterwatch.com, which gets into the water issues where I live in Southern Colorado. Another one is gangstalkingmindcontrolcults.com. And then finally, my music website, which is the only one that I actually charge anything for. I have put out a bunch of CDs because music has always been one of my first loves. EricKarlstrom.com. I have a bunch of CDs out and still cranking away on that. I've recorded two this fall, so I'll be producing those in the spring. But yeah, today we'll be talking a little bit about the information that's on my naturalclimatechange.org website, so we can so people, if they want to, you know, can kind of browse through that even as we talk.
Excellent. And the one I was missing was the San Luis Valley waterwatch.com website. So I've made a note of that, Eric, and that will be included in the post for this show and all subsequent posts for shows that we do in the future. Now, as I say, the title is Agenda 21 and the Man-Caused Global Warming Fraud. So do you want to tell me how you want to do this? Do you want to tackle Agenda 21 first? You lead us into the topic the best way that you see fit, please.
Okay. Well, you know, I have a PhD in physical geography, and my expertise or my focus in research and in teaching was always landforms, soils, climate change, paleoclimate reconstruction. That's the reconstruction of past climates from the physical evidence that we examine on the Earth, you know, in soils and geomorphology, landforms, et cetera. And so I got my PhD at the University of Calgary in 1981, my master's at the University of Wyoming in 1977, and began teaching in 81 at Northern Arizona University. I was part of a program there called the Quaternary Studies Program. And of course, the Quaternary is the last 2 to 3 million years of Earth history, Quaternary period. And it coincides with what we call the ice ages, when you have, you know, major climate fluctuations going from full glacial conditions in which, you know, Canada is essentially covered with 1 to 2 to even 3 miles of vertical of ice, big continental ice sheet over Canada, as well as most of Britain, as well as, you know, the northern parts of Eurasia. And of course, sea levels would have dropped, you know, about 300 or 400 feet worldwide because of all the water that's stored in these larger ice caps. And so what we see by looking at all the proxy records, that is to say the indirect methods for reconstructing past climates, you know, such as the analysis of soils and landforms and pollen and fossils and deep sea cores and ice cores on the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets, etc. Many, many different kinds, and many, many scientists have been examining this over the many decades. And what we see is a pattern of fairly cyclical climate change with over the last 2 to 3 million years, with maybe 20 full glacial conditions, that is to say when the ice was at its maximum, you know, and these continental sheets in the United States have come down to, you know, Illinois, Wisconsin, and even down into parts of Kansas and Missouri. And then 20, and these are separated then by 20 interglacial periods or periods of relative warmth. And, you know, these periods of warmth then are actually periods in which plants and animals do much better. In the cold times, of course, all these ecosystem elements, the animals and the plants and the humans, have to migrate down towards the equator to find their optimal, you know, niche of you know, temperature and moisture, et cetera, so that they can survive. And so all these plants and animals and humans are kind of adjusting all the time over the last 2 to 3 million years and right on back through, through, you know, the last 500 and 600 million years, you know, since multicellular life developed on this planet, always adjusting to this external forcing factor, which is, you know, climate. And climate is nothing but average weather. So I taught climatology, I taught physical geography, I taught soils, landforms, quaternary environments, geology courses, etc. So pretty well versed in this. And as I was getting my PhD in 1981, I was looking at the glacial history of Glacier and Waterton Park by examining, again, soils and landforms. And this big slow train of man-caused global warming had already kind of gathered some momentum. And there was kind of, I thought it was great at the time because this meant, you know, more research dollars for the young and fairly small study of climatology. And I didn't realize at that time that this was going to build up into a huge gravy train for research that was going to promote a particular agenda, a political agenda, which happened to coincide with what later became named United Nations Agenda 21, which is the agenda for the 21st century, which was rolled out at the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. The document itself, Agenda 21, was obviously prepared by United Nations aficionados and bureaucrats long in advance. And there was actually quite a PR push to try to get the world to sign on to the radical changes, economic and political restructuring of the world's political map and economy that the UN had in mind. And of course, the UN had in mind being the prototypical world government and funding it through carbon taxes largely. And carbon taxes then, of course, would be the taxes that individuals and nations would pay to the United Nations for the privilege of burning fossil fuels, coal, gas, oil. And of course, 85% of the world's energy sources are these fossil fuels. And when one burns fossil fuels, one, you know, creates carbon dioxide. So they needed a way to get control of this economic activity. And if you look at the UN documents, they have in mind deindustrializing the industrial countries and keeping the third world countries down so they never industrialize. In other words, the poorening of the world and the reduction of the human population, you know, by a significant amount. So they needed a way to kind of get this kind of control. So they needed then this kind of storyline that carbon dioxide was bad and that it was destroying the planet. You know, and that not only was it destroying the planet, but we, the human beings who are driving their cars and trucks and whatnot, who are burning fossil fuels, which emit some CO2, we are the culprits of doing, then we have to pay these taxes. Well, of course, there's a lot of lies embedded in this whole scenario. And this has become obvious to many of us. And I have right next to me on my kitchen table, I don't know, about 15 books that are right off my shelf that are address these issues. Titles such as The Deliberate Corruption of Climate Science, Global Warming, False Alarm, Slaying the Sky Dragon, Climate of Corruption, Unstoppable Global Warming Every 1500 Years, Climate, the Counter Consensus, The Deniers, Climate Coup, Power Grab, Climatism, Real Global Warming Disaster, Red Hot Lies, How Global Warming Alarmists Use Threats, Fraud, and Deception to Keep You Misinformed, Climate Confusion, The Chilling Stars, Climate Change Reconsidered, The Report of the Non-Governmental International Panel on Climate Change, etc. So, and then on my website, naturalclimatechange.org, if you look under, if you go to that website, you'll see a homepage, and then you'll see a bunch of headings. And if you go to the left, under Climate Science has a bunch of articles and PowerPoint presentations. Under that, you have disproofs of AGW, which stands for Anthropogenic Global Warming, disproofs of AGW hypothesis. You'll see the first article is disproofs of man-induced global warming, which is about an 80 or 90 page article that I wrote in 2011 for my students and any policymakers and anybody who's interested in this, which disproves this bogus hypothesis on the basis of science and shows the political reasons why it is being promoted. Now, it's kind of common in academics that we're all, you know, focused in our own little specialties. So, for instance, my parents, who are both academics, you know, with PhDs, you know, cautioned, no, you shouldn't mix politics and science. And I, you know, came back with, hey, you have to mix politics and science because they've already mixed politics and science. You know, science has been co-opted by politics in this case. And so with all these research dollars, they've been able to, you know, and of course, funding these gigantic computer models that are some 20 some of them that different universities that make these climate projections based on the deterministic models they've put together of they think they know how the climate system works, which, of course, they know part of how the climate system works. But it's an infinite, almost infinitely complex system. In fact, the difference between weather and climate is that weather is the day-to-day changes of temperature and moisture and winds, et cetera. And climate is kind of the average conditions, maybe averaged over a 30-year period for particular areas or, you know, of different scales up to the size of the planet. And so not only is weather changing constantly in a chaotic direction, in a chaotic manner, because indeed the whole study of chaos comes from meteorology, because a meteorologist by the name of Lorenz back in the 1950s determined that it was impossible to predict the weather for more than, say, 10 days out in, ahead because of this thing called sensitive dependence on initial conditions, the butterfly effect. You know, when a butterfly flaps its wings in Iowa, you know, a whole cascade of effects could manifest, and then you know could generate a hurricane, you know, off the Bahamas or something like that. That's the idea, and because one can't predict what these effects are going to be exactly, because it's a non-deterministic system, you know, you have it's nonlinear. It's not a simple X and Y axis as is presented, you know, with the temperature going up, with the CO2 going up. I mean, that's a fable. So, you know, the study of chaos comes out of meteorology. Well, the same problem faces us, really, with predicting future climate. And yet we have these 20-some different supercomputer models going, all of which have made projections for the year 2100. Based on a, say, doubling of the CO2 on the planet, and all of them have been proved wrong. These things predict an increase of temperature by 1 to 11 degrees Fahrenheit, and all of them have been proven wrong because the climate, actual climate, as far as we can measure it, has been the temperature has been decreasing very slightly since 1998. So, you know, I mean, all the models have now been proven wrong. They want us to believe that, you know, that there's an emergency, that there's a catastrophe. And the politicians jump onto this with the lines that they are fed, you know, like, one presidential candidate said, oh, this will make World War III look like a picnic, you know, this. And Angela Merkel said something to the, you know, the effect that this is going to destroy the planet and human civilization. And James Lovelock, the great scientist who comes from Britain, who comes up with the Gaia hypothesis, said by the year 2100, you know, humanity will be reduced to a couple breeding pairs that will live in Antarctica. All of the ice will have melted in Antarctica, and now we'll just have, you know, just a handful of humans. I mean, this is so ridiculous and irresponsible. If one knows anything about the history of Earth science, the history of the Earth, but of course, this kind of fear mongering gets traction with the media and scares people, scares kids, you know, oh, we're killing the polar bears, you know, and blah, 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 blah. This is a gigantic propaganda ploy, unfortunately, has no scientific legs. It's easily disproven. As one climatologist said, you know, this hypothesis doesn't meet the standard of an eighth grade science fair. You know, I mean, it's so easy to disprove this hypothesis, and yet it won't go away. And that's what we need to talk about. It won't go away because it serves a very important political function. And the political function that it performs is that it is the justification for what they call Plan A and Plan B, right in their own documents. Now, the National Academy of Sciences has a document, 1991, called Policy Implications of Greenhouse Warming. So they assume then greenhouse warming is a fact, which, of course, it isn't. And we can talk about that. But you got this big, big, big fat book with lots of chapters by lots of people, most of whom are not scientists, saying, okay, what are going to be the policy of this warming? What policies are we going to adopt? And in this book, they say, well, okay, we're going to have Plan A. And Plan A, of course, is these carbon taxes that gives the UN then the right and the power to limit the use of fossil fuels to essentially deindustrialize the industrial countries. And people like Marie Strong, who wrote Agenda 21, have many, many statements out to the effect that, you know, we're destroying the planet and we have to, you know, we have to live a much more primitive lifestyle. We have to stop burning fossil fuels, have to live in smaller homes. We have to stop eating meat. We have to, you know, we have to voluntarily sacrifice our lifestyle to, you know, that of a third worlder, basically. And of course, this didn't go over too well, although he was considered the savior of the planet in the press anyway. But it didn't go over well. You know, the United States didn't sign on to the climate conventions because, you know, any idiot can see this is going to result in the destruction of the American economy and the industrialized world. And of course, this is still on the table with the Paris conferences, you know, the Copenhagen conferences, the Kyoto conferences. Kyoto Protocol Phase 2 says, you know, we have to eliminate use of fossil fuels by the year 2050 so that we're back down to the alternative wind and solar, essentially the green energy. And of course, if you take nuclear power off the table and all you have is wind and solar, then, you know, that really throws you into a third world lifestyle because the wind doesn't blow all the time and the sun doesn't shine all the time. So these are always going to be niche sources of power that will only give you maybe 10 or 20% of your total energy needs. You can't run a steel plant on wind and solar, for instance. So what they're saying is, okay, we're going to cut off civilization, human civilization, from fossil fuels, which is this tremendous gift from nature, really, and there seems to be a lot of it. And what we're going to do, you know, this will throw us into a pre-industrial revolution lifestyle, really, because now the lifespans will be shorter. We won't be able to support as many human beings. Okay, now they have their depopulation agenda accomplished right there. You know, if you brought us back to a 1850 energy pattern, you'd eventually bring us right back to an 1850 world population, you know, more or less of necessity. And that'd throw us down to a billion or less, which of course means the elimination of 6.5 billion people, you know, the greatest crime in the history of the Earth. And this is what they actually envision and have been striving for relentlessly. These are eugenicists, you know, our global leaders who, you know, they run these think tanks like the Club of Rome and the Council on Foreign Relations and the Royal International Institute, Royal Institute of International Affairs, RIIA, of which the CFR is a kind of a extension member. So, you know, all this is to bring in a gigantic plan, which is actually enunciated in Agenda 21 with the UN as prototypical world government. And now they call it Agenda 2030 because they say, well, we got to get this thing cemented in by 2030.
And Eric, just a quick question. Yeah. With regard to, firstly, fossil fuels, do you believe the theory that these aren't actually produced by all these dead dinosaurs, etc., and it's actually something that replenishes itself from the Earth? It's something that the Earth itself produces. And the other question is why are they so keen to depopulate the world? Is it, if they got any scientific basis for that, or is it just a matter of, you know, they're satanic, they're evil, and they want to get rid of 6.5 billion people?
Both are excellent. And, you know, the first question, I've certainly read and come across the idea that, you know, fossil fuels are inorganic carbon sources, and that, you know, you find them produced near the upper mantle, you know, right below the crust, and that they kind of drift upwards. Apparently there are Russian scientists who are behind this. Of course, I grew up, you know, with the kind of more traditional view that they are mostly organic sources of carbon. Of course, life is carbon-based. And so I'm a little unsure and agnostic on that issue. I mean, my arguments and my, you know, my positions on these things don't really depend on the answer to that debate. I now know that this whole peak oil thing that I would have taught in my human ecology classes for years, that we're, you know, the Earth is peaking out, you know, maybe by 2005 or 2013 or whatever, and this, the production of oil on the planet or in any given province that produces oil is like a bell curve, and then it, you know, goes up to the fairly flat plateau and then it comes down. You know, this was again, this was the M. King Hubbard hypothesis of the 50s, and it really caught on in the 90s and the 2000s. We now know that that's wrong. There's a lot of oil. So whether it's, you know, mostly organic or mostly inorganic carbon, from, you know, the basic issue doesn't change. It does seem that we have much more oil and gas than we thought. And we always knew we had lots and lots of coal. So, and we probably got free energy too. I mean, that's a whole nother debate. You know, Judy Wood and the directed energy people talk about free energy, which of course would really let the cat out of the bag and make sure those Africans never starve again, you know, but they don't want to share that. So that gets into the next question. Why do the elites want to get rid of most of the human population? And we know they do, because there's so many statements to that effect. You know, Ted Turner says, you know, well, we got to get down to 500 million global population, you know, which means get rid of 7 billion. Even Jacques Cousteau says, well, you know, to get down to the right population, we really have to start thinking about killing 350,000 people a day. And he says, well, it's terrible to say it, but it's even worse not to say it. And of course, all this is to save this Earth, you know, this rock that's going around the sun, that it happens to have this magnificent biosphere on it, which we, of course, absolutely depend on every single moment, every single second, the air we breathe and the water we drink, et cetera. But this notion of scarcity goes back to, you know, Thomas Malthus, the Anglican priest in Britain, who was famous for saying, you know, well, the food supply expands arithmetically, and it has to because there's a finite amount of land, and the population increases exponentially, you know, multiplicatively. So therefore, the population is going to outpace the food production. Therefore, you know, society is going to move in the direction of dwarfism and, you know, starvation and misery. And therefore, we have to control the human population. And this idea, this Malthusian philosophy, then kind of informs all the, you know, all the ecology books and biology books and, you know, that sort of thing. It's axiomatic that, you know, that exponential population growth is a is a huge problem. So when I taught my human ecology class, you know, I would have taught these huge problems. And basically, this is kind of a propaganda for the students, you know, environmentalism then, you know, kind of joins feminism and multiculturalism as a important core curriculum, outcomes-based education, to use UN terminology. And the UN has their, you know, educational agenda, as well as their spiritual agenda, as well as their energy agenda, as well as their agenda for everything. I mean, they want to control the world. But yeah, this and I taught this for 22 years, human ecology. And so for the first 10 years, I would have taught it basically from the perspective of a typical biology textbook, you know, which talks about all these drastic, terrible problems. And it was quite depressing. And then about the year 2000, I started to look at it from the other angle. And then I started to, you know, more the right wing angle, and realized that a lot of this was propaganda. And that, you know, used books that, you know, like The Greening by Abrahams, or Abrams, I guess his name, you know, and, you know, just in order to, of course, my students had been brought up with this ecological thinking from first grade on. So this was a big shock to them. But after the year 2000, I started looking at it from the other perspective, and realized the other perspective was much closer to the truth.
You also talked to Eric about your when you basically presented to your students that this man-made climate change was complete nonsense. Did you get any backlash from the university authorities when you did that? Because we know how embedded these lies are in these senior people, certainly today. I think that if you were to teach anything like that, you'd be, you know, regarded as a heretic, and you know, it's lies what you're teaching. Did you get any backlash at all?
And that's a very interesting question. And of course, yes, I did. But it was mostly, well, yes, I got a lot of backlash. you know, I had a big fight to get tenure, and I did get tenure because I had the facts on my side. And then I got to associate, you move up through the ranks, you know, in academics. So I got a tenure track job, then I eventually got tenure, and then I eventually got, and of course, with that, you go from assistant professor to associate professor, and then you go up, and, you know, you present your file, and you get judged by everybody in the world to determine whether you go up the ladder to the next step, which is associate professor. And then with that, you get tenure. And from assistant professor, it's conditional, it's provisional until you get tenure and associate professor. Usually they come together, and then you go up again. And if you are deemed worthy by your colleagues, you get full professor. Well, I got, you know, I was going through this process in the 90s and the 2000s. So I did get a backlash, you know, at the point of tenure from my own department. But I did get it. And because I, you know, I fought for it because I had the facts on my side. I'd published more than the rest of my department together, put together, and there were eight of them at the time. You know, so, you know, and you know, the case was pretty hard to refute. Yeah, when I did this, and then I became full professor. And then once you're full professor, you're pretty much at the top of the scale. You know, the administrators come and go, and the faculty kind of stay. So I was pretty secure there. But when I shifted the focus of my class, human ecology there started about the time I started in 1990. And of all over the country, this was introduced to college curricula. And I think very much as part of this push for Agenda 21, the Rio Earth Summit. In other words, this was very coordinated. And of course, this would have been behind the scenes. When I got to California State University Stanislaus in 1990, all of a sudden, everybody's supposed to capitalize the E on the word Earth, you know. In the 80s, the Earth started with a little E. And in the 90s, it was a big E. Why? Because now the Earth is sacred. And this, again, is this propaganda thing. We're going to worship the Gaia, you know, Mother Earth goddess. And we're going to become environmentalists, and it's going to become like a religion. Well, it did. And so when I went down, and of course, I was a believer initially, I loved hiking and climbing and skiing and all the outdoor activities. And I grew up in, you know, in Flagstaff, Arizona, other places like that near the Grand Canyon, where these opportunities were abundant. And I took advantage of them to the full, climbed lots of mountains all over the world. And, you know, so I love the earth. But then I realized, of course, that this was being used to sell. This eco-spirituality is being used to sell this Agenda 21. And nothing can be more clear than to look at the actual record, which I've done on my website. But to finish your question, which I think is an interesting one, when I made my shift from teaching human ecology properly, which meant, you know, as a kind of a propaganda thing, we're all going to die, gloom and doom, you're wrecking the earth. It was depressing for students and professors to do this, you know. When I made my shift in 2000 and started teaching from the right-wing side of things, my class size shrunk from about 125 down to around 20. Well, this was done by behind-the-scenes manipulations of the people who make the schedules and decide which courses fulfill which requirements for which majors, et cetera. Now, this could, of course, been a coincidence, but I doubt it, you know. So I was the guy who taught climatology, but I was the only professor that I know of on campus that questioned this almost, you know, sacrosanct idea that humans were wrecking the planet by burning fossil fuels. And then I think it came to a head in the year 2009 when I was teaching my climatology class. I just about had an insurrection. Some of the, you know, diehard students who were, you know, very much of the opinion that humans were, it was their religion now. The centerpiece of this environmental religion is the man-caused global warming catastrophe. And a couple of female students got very upset and, you know, I think even kind of yelled at the professor once or twice and walked out of the class. And so then the rest of the class is in shock, you know, wondering, gee, who do we believe, these smart students who, you know, seem to know what they're talking about? Or do we believe our professor? Well, that was the semester that ClimateGate broke. And ClimateGate was this kind of scandal where a bunch of emails were hacked from the Climate Research Unit, CRU, at the University of East Anglia, in Britain, of course, that showed that this group under Phil Jones, who was the director, was actually fudging the data and was acting as a team to advance this idea, and was like, you know, it was like a war. They were going to take down the enemies who were saying the wrong things, and they were going to promote the right thing. And they were obviously well paid for this. So ClimateGate broke, and all of a sudden, you know, my smarter students realized that, well, maybe the professor is right here. And shortly thereafter, of course, AussieGate and KiwiGate broke, similar manipulations with the data, falsifications, to make the appearance that the temperature's going up. you know, the whole thing is just a phenomenal joke. It's a phenomenal corruption of a relatively small science. But again, I was the only professor who was saying what I did. So my students would come to me and say, well, Dr. Carlstrom, you say that, you know, that humans aren't causing radical global warming, and Professor so-and-so says that it is. You know, what are we supposed to believe? And I would say, well, now's a good chance for you to use your critical thinking skills, you know. And at the university I taught at, which was a teaching university, not a big research school like, say, UC Berkeley, we had more one-on-one with the students. But our students were not perhaps of the same, you know, in general, they were not of the same caliber as the students of University of California and, you know, the research schools, which are the top tier universities. And many of my students were capable of critical thinking, independent critical thinking, and many weren't. You know, they basically needed, you know, you give me the answer, I'll write it down. You know, they're not capable of going and investigating these things for themselves by, say, reading a book or reading five books or, you know, reading some articles or reading five articles, which is what's required, of course, when you get to something as complex as climate change.
Very interesting, Eric. And, you've really talked us through the subject, and you've, you know, that's why I wanted to hand over to you at the start of the show and just for you to run through all your data. And it's clear to me that this man-made climate change is a complete joke. And we go back to the term that I grew up with in the 80s, and it was always global warming, global warming. And then when they found out, as you said, from 1998 that the planet is actually cooling, they changed it to climate change, because they couldn't change it to global cooling, because that would be the opposite of what they were worrying us about all the way up to that point. But by saying climate change, it covers them on both ends. Is that why they introduced the new term, Eric?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is propaganda. So it's always a sliding goalpost, you know. But you know, I haven't gotten to Plan B, Andy. And Plan B, of course, which is laid out in the policy implications of greenhouse warming by the National Academy of Sciences, which is the most prestigious equivalent, really, to your Royal Academy, Royal Academy over there in Britain. Plan B. Okay, maybe the people of the world are not going to go along with voluntary deindustrialization. You know, yeah, we want grandma to die, you know, because she's not going to get enough heat in her house in Minnesota, you know. So maybe there's too much resistance. So Plan B then is geoengineering. We then are going to modify the amount of incoming solar radiation, for instance, called solar radiation management, to block incoming solar radiation, to cool this planet because of the runaway warming, which supposedly exists but doesn't. And, of course, geoengineering, now this is a whole other can of worms. It's a huge topic. I think we've talked about it. Weather warfare is kind of the dark underbelly of geoengineering. Weather warfare has been going on since World War II and even during World War II. And the Air Force wrote a paper in 1996 called Using the Weather as a Force Multiplier, Owning the Weather in 2025. Well, you know, 1962 to 1983, the military did a whole series of experiments on, you know, how to steer and manipulate and juice up and knock down hurricanes. So that, you know, and they figured they could do that by at least 30%. And this is, you know, decades old technology or capabilities. We can steer the jet stream. We can cause drought and floods anywhere in the planet. We can cause hurricanes and create them, juice them up, steer them. And of course, with perfect plausible deniability, nature did it, you know. And so how do you tell a geoengineered hurricane from a natural hurricane, or a geoengineered earthquake from a natural earthquake, or a geoengineered tornado from a natural tornado? And so it can then be used as state-sponsored terrorism, which it is being used as state-sponsored terrorism. If a nation doesn't go along with the program and the United States wants to punish that nation, look at the tools it now has. And of course, because the whole global warming fraud fulfills both of these objectives of, you know, the centerpiece of the environmental movement, which is supposed to throw us into, you know, global government under the UN, and then also the justification for controlling the weather, which has been the goal along anyway, it won't go away. So it doesn't matter how many books you have or how, you know, how much you've disproved this stupid hypothesis. All the data disproves it. God has disproven it, you know, because the temperatures on the planet are cooling. And of course, the much greater threat to the planet is cooling, because warming is basically good for plants and animals and humans. You know, so there's so many, you know, whys at every stage of this thing. But the reason it won't go away is because it serves these two gigantic agendas. And that's really the point I wanted to make here, Andy. Geoengineering, weather warfare, weather modification has been with us since World War II. All the patents are there. All the military documents are there. All the laws are there. People can go to a PowerPoint that I put together in 2011 for a panel discussion at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco called Man-Made Climate Change in the Skies. And that's on my Natural Climate Change website under the heading of geoengineering weather, and it's called Man-Made Climate Change in the Skies. It goes through the patents, you know, for, you know, how we're going to control the weather, including the chemtrails, you know, and all the geoengineering steering the hurricanes, etc. And so, you know, and it goes to the laws. It goes to the fact that in 2010, even while Congress was denying that the chemtrails were happening, the House of Commons in Britain was working with the House of Representatives in the United States to come up with some laws which would regulate just that, geoengineering. So it has been completely unregulated, and it still is completely unregulated in the sense that any corporation, and there are many weather modification companies, can use these technologies to go ahead and create more rain here, to reduce impacts of hurricanes in the Pacific area, or you know, anywhere they occur. The private companies then are kind of mixed in with the military now, in terms of their capabilities to do this geoengineering. So this is why the global warming hypothesis, a man-caused global warming hypothesis, won't go away, because it serves these political agendas. And of course, what I learned, you know, through my career is that politics trumps science. You know, who pays the piper calls the tune.
Don't some organizations approach professors and say, right, we want you to write a paper proving this, for example, proving man-made climate change exists, and if you write it, you'll get a $50,000 grant. But if you don't write it, they actually basically tell them what they want the outcome to be before they've done the research. Is that correct?
Yeah, maybe it's not quite so direct as that. But yeah, all professors, of course, who are, you know, in this very, very highly competitive situation at universities, they're trying to remove tenure now. So, you know, about half the professors at universities now are part-timers with no benefits, you know. So they're, you know, it's almost just a step up from working at McDonald's. But the ones who are lucky enough to be on tenure track positions, and therefore, you know, get this guarantee of more or less a lifetime employment at a fairly stable institution, they are under the gun, more or less, at different universities to publish, to pull in grants. And of course, the granting agencies then and the editors of the journals then have power to determine, you know, who gets the grant money, who gets published. And if they get their people, like the, you know, the climate research unit, they get their little coterie of you know, believers or their team positioned as editors of the various journals, then, you know, the right storyline gets out and the wrong storyline, like mine, doesn't get out. It gets marginalized, you know. So and then, you know, again, the same dynamic occurs with approving grants. I mean, you know, both my brothers are at prestigious universities that, you know, and they've been playing this grant game for a long time. And, you know, the percentage of grant proposals that are funded keeps going down. So, you know, I think my brother who's is in neurobiology, actually, at UMass, University of Massachusetts, you know, I think it's down below 10% of the grant proposals now are funded. So you have highly motivated, highly intelligent people writing a lot of grant proposals, and this the ante gets higher and higher to get those grant proposals, or get those grant fundings, funds. So, and then also, as one of my students pointed out in the class, I did get a group of students who were kind of my allies eventually on this. And they were actually out there, you know, kind of as extra eyes and ears for me. And one came in with the factoid that there were 700 university presidents who had signed on to a climate initiative. Okay, so again, this would be all bureaucratic, political. If you're a president and you sign on to this initiative, then, you know, there's going to be more money available to your university. So, of course, they're going to do it, you know. And, of course, none of these people probably have any background in climatology. You know, they're all in various other fields. So it's not based on science. It's based on, you know, political self-interest. And so the whole system then gets geared because the money is behind it. And the system gets, you know, and, of course, all those grants then come with some strings attached. You know, you better come up with kind of the right conclusions here. Or else you might not get funded next year. You know, so this is the way that money corrupts science and politics.
That's very interesting. And we covered the, I mean, basically, I think that we've done enough to prove on this show, or rather you have, that man-made climate change is a total fraud. Now, with Agenda 21, we talked about certain different aspects of it on, you know, the way that they were looking to do the carbon taxes and things like that. Have you got any other information that you can give us? Just to let you know, we've got about 10 minutes left, so feel free to throw anything else in that you plan to cover that you've not had the opportunity to do so yet, because I really want you to get all the information you want to get out, Eric. But my question is, any other information on things like other plans to depopulate us, other aspects of Agenda 21 that you've not gone into?
Absolutely. This is a huge subject as well. And, you know, if you go to my, or if anybody goes to my gangstalkingmindcontrolcults.com, which of course is carried out by the same, you know, elite, and my 911nwo.com websites, I have a series of posts. I have a subheading called New World Order on my gangstalkingmindcontrolcults.com site. And here, let me just give you a couple of my posts. One's called Smart Cities, Smart Growth, Mega Regions, Agenda 21's Frenzy Planning for Global Policing and Stacked Housing Roles in the USA. Let's see here as we go down. This course has other... the Jewish British American Plan for World Conquest, Protocols as Blueprint for Psychopathic Judeo-Masonic Satanists. That's related, actually. But the one I'm trying to find here, actually quite a ways down. I can't have them all at the top. Hurricane Harvey as Weather Warfare, Parts 1, 2, and 3, interviews that I have with Romola D. So that you know, that's obviously related. Let's see here. Well, the one I have is got the 17 goals of Agenda 2030, and it kind of deconstructs these goals. Here's one: is gang stalking a population reduction program? USA population projected to decrease by 81%. By 2025, Hitchcock and Walsh interview. I got that on there.
Excellent.
U.S. military. Okay. Well, anyway, this is way down here. I've got so many posts here. But there it is. Hypothesis. UN Agenda 21 is actually tikkun olam. This is my hypothesis, which is the Hebrew word, you know, for mending the earth or reinventing the earth, another term for Jewish utopia, and fulfillment of the Rothschild Illuminati plan, which, you know, dates back to 1776, as you well know, at the beginning of the Bavarian Illuminati, which is the satanic Jewish group that took over the upper degrees of Masonry at that time, or in 1782 at the Council of Wilhelmsbad. But anyway, so this article then talks about these 17 goals of Agenda 2030, and then compares that with the original Illuminati plan of 1776. And then it deconstructs the language embedded in these goals, which of course is very Orwellian, you know, like war is peace, freedom is slavery, you know, every goal basically is shown to actually be kind of the opposite of what is stated. You know, these are very nice sounding goals, you know, like end poverty in all its forms everywhere. And then I have translations of those. Translation one is put everyone on government welfare, food stamps, housing subsidies and handouts that make them obedient slaves to global government, never allow people upward mobility to help themselves, instead teach mass victimization and obedience to a government that provides monthly allowance money for basic essentials like food and medicine, label it ending poverty. Okay, translation two, and this would be by somebody else who actually has looked into this, that translates ending poverty in all its forms everywhere, translates to centralized banks, IMF, World Bank, Fed to control all finances. And I'll do translation three here right now, kill the poor. genocide the poor, you know, with the geoengineering, et cetera. Goal two, end hunger, achieve food security and improve nutrition and promote sustainable agriculture. Translation one, invade the entire planet with GMOs and Monsanto's patented seeds while increasing the use of deadly herbicides under the false claim of increased output of food crops. Engineer genetically modified plants to boost specific vitamin chemicals while having no idea of the long-term consequences of genetic pollution or cross-species genetic experiments carried out openly in a fragile ecosystem. Translation 2, GMO. So each of these 17 goals then appear quite benign and, you know, actually desirable. But if you look at the actual history of what the United Nations has tried to implement, you see that actually they're going in a very different direction and that these terms are very deceptive. And so we not only have this grand overarching Agenda 21, 2030, but we also have local Agenda 21 to be implemented at your county, state, city level. And we have smart cities now all over America that are all signed on to these Agenda 21 changes. So this has been incrementally introduced. All of our federal agencies like BLM, Bureau of Land Management, Forest Service, Park Service, would now have signed on to Agenda 21. In 1992, 179 nations signed on to it without having their populations know anything about it. So that was at the Rio Earth Summit or right afterwards. So the world has been incrementally moving in this direction. This has been the bureaucratic spread. And then, of course, all of this agenda is pushed by this phony environmental movement. We can use the analogy of the watermelon environmentalist that's green on the outside and red on the inside. And, you know, it's basic communism, you know, Soviet style bureaucracies then replace actual democratic institutions where the people have a voice. So again, you know, this is the soft path towards world totalitarian government. You could say the neocons, you know, and their hot wars in the Middle East and their special operations forces, you know, destabilizing nations all over the world. That's the United States, by the way, military. This is the hard path to global tyranny. The soft path is the United Nations push towards one world government. And that's been moving along, even as we have one, you know, crisis after another. You know, here's Hurricane Harvey. Here's the Las Vegas shooting. Here's this shooting. Here's that. You know, we have London 7/7. We have Spain, blah, 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 blah. All these manufactured terrorist events are designed to keep us in a dissociative, catatonic state. And we're confused and we're anxious and we're not watching the, you know, what's happening slow motion. And this is the Fabian socialism technique, you know, this, the cultural marks of the cultural Marxism, the long march through the cultural institutions. This is what the UN Agenda 2030 is. This is what's going on kind of under the surface, but it's taking over from under the surface. So I think it's a very important discussion that we're having today, Andy, and it ties in with everything else we've talked about.
Absolutely, Eric. And just another thing I'll mention, I probably should have asked you off air, but your Water Watch website, we haven't done any shows on that, so we've got the next one sorted out, what we're going to talk about. But if you'd like to do something on that, then we can draw attention to that if you would like.
I think that would be perfect, because the Water Watch Alliance is a site that I put together during a sabbatical I had in 2008, in which I started to examine the water issues right here in the San Luis Valley. And Marie Strong, the Canadian who is, you know, the Secretary General of Rio Earth Summit 1992 and the organizer of the 1972 Stockholm UN Convention and the Rio Plus 20 conference in 2012. In other words, probably the most powerful behind the scenes UN bureaucrat of all times and the quote unquote savior of the planet, who also happened to be a billionaire from, you know, being CEO of all these gas and oil and water corporations. So, you know, wearing one hat, white hat, and then a black hat, et cetera. He bought the Baca Ranch right next to where I live, 12 square miles, which is sitting over this gigantic aquifer. And he and his partners tried to export the water, you know, as private entities. and sell it to the city of Denver, this would have required a pipeline through or over the Rocky Mountains, which are quite high. This plan was thwarted, but he would have made another $1 billion if this plan had gone through. So here he is, the savior of the planet, the guy who wrote Agenda 21, and he wants to, you know, I mean, the hypocrisy, you can't even, you know, wrap your head around it. And this is what really helped, when I looked at his life in particular, this helped me see through the environmental scam.
Thank you very much, Eric. Great show again today. And Eric and I will be back with another show in a couple of weeks for you all. So I will be back with you all tomorrow. I want to thank you all for listening, and bye for now.
You have been listening to the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show on the Eurofolk Radio Network. Andrew's book, The Synagogue of Satan, is now available on his website, andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com, in an updated, expanded, and uncensored edition.